to talk tonight about the remembrance of clear seeing. From one perspective, if we look at our life or our lives, we see that there's been a kind of progression of learning. There's been a progression of experiences. There's been a sense of progression in time. To that we give words like journey or path. We at times attempt to construct a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose. And in there, of course, there's a sense of trying to understand, trying to make sense of. What we less frequently see is that to some extent we're trying to remember something. Insight meditation, for some, starts out as a practice that you get kind of collected. You kind of come together in something like breathing or bodily awareness, bodily sensation. And in Burma alone, by the way, you might notice that Myanmar is moving back towards becoming Burma, which is what it was for many, 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 many years called until the title was changed by the still current rulers, who are, you might say, getting older. One way to put it. In Burma alone, there's about 40 different, very, very strong lineages that teach Vipassana or insight meditation. The word Vipassana means insight, or sometimes translated as to see clearly. So what that means is that it's stylized in different ways. And it's stylized in different ways because the people who are kind of generating that style, they're different. You know, it's like you look around this room and you can see we're all human beings, or there is at least body sitting here, by the way. Human being is a concept. Even body is a concept. Well, we could say there's bodies sitting here. Now all these bodies are bodies, right? But they can look very different. They can at times behave very different. They can almost seem like maybe these two so-called human beings, you know, one person will say to the other, you know, I just realized you're not even a human being. Okay, or you might come to that insight yourself, like the other person's behaving like a human being and you're the one who has gone into some other kind of behavior that we'll leave off what that might be called. Different. So, insight meditation, when it really comes together, it is about seeing life itself, the nature of life itself. What is life? What is this living, you could say, reality? What is it? Experientially coming to clarity, you might say, or insight into that. Not part of life, but whole life, all of life. What is life? And so instead of that being a philosophical consideration, it's a direct experiential exploration. And we can see, even just with a few hours of practicing together, that kind of allowing this, you could say, opening into seeing life more fully, more clearly, is not entirely easy. I mean, I'm not saying it's hard necessarily in moments. It might not seem hard at all. It might seem very easy. But contrasted to how we can live our lives, the patterns, the habits, the responsibilities we carry, sometimes, even if you've done a lot of this stuff, you come in and you sit, and it's quite something to really face oneself, so to speak. To really, really, if you will, the image might be look in the mirror. But this is exactly what has to happen for this clear seeing of remembrance, or this remembrance of clear seeing, I could say it either way, to have a chance to wake up or to come forth. We can't be living, at least for certain moments, if this is going to do what it can do, in partial bias, in particularized view of life. As you see, even just in a 45-minute period of sitting, the sense of choosing things completely goes away. Things are just happening. There is no choice being made about the sensations and the breath and where the breath is. I mean, you can, so to speak, try to get in there and manipulate it, but the suggestion is very consistent here, and that's not what this is about. This is not the meditation on having certain particular experiences. This is not the meditation on getting to some state and hold it. Partly because that's impossible. And it leads to more agony, and it's agonizing enough at times to be alive. But there's another possibility, which is, this is the meditation, or this is the teaching, when I say on direct experience, this is the teaching about seeing the nature of experiences, not collecting certain experiences, not putting a hierarchy on experiences and saying this is what the meditation is about and getting into this particular state and then keeping it. There's nothing right, wrong, or right to that matter, with getting calm, getting tranquil, becoming more peaceful. How about becoming more loving, becoming more kind, becoming more generous? Wonderful things. Who would disagree? You find anybody, or if you look at yourself, can you sustain any of that? Can you sustain, even if you have an idea of being loving all the time, and you actually get into that room in the house of your mind, heart, and you sustain, how long can you sustain that? Again, no pun intended, but it's literally like holding your breath. And, or you can go the other way around, blow it out, and try to stay there. Although that's a graphic example of how life doesn't allow anything to last. But when we move it over into this, you could say, differentiation between trying to have certain experiences and keep them, what I call meditation on having certain experiences, the difference between that and the meditation, or the observation, or the exploration of the nature of experiences, very, very different. And it's a game, okay? Life is a game. Many games, actually. Games within games. But if there's a real game, if there's a game that you could say is most important, at least to some people, it would be the spiritual game. It would be the game of discovering what you are. It would be the game of waking up from the trance of suffering. It would be the game of discovering, while alive, how to come out of conflict, neurosis, or those kind of moments when people might be thinking, you know, I'm a human being, but you're not. Those moments. It's a kind of very serious game. I mean, it's a kind of serious game to be here, alive, and to actually be interested and to have the time, the opportunity, the assets, the support, to not just roll along with life. Because a lot of people, like I like to say here, you know, today, many people, more people on planet Earth today don't have enough to eat. They don't have time to sit and investigate awareness. You know, they're looking for how they're going to eat and how they're going to have shelter. And there's people tonight who are women, particularly birthing babies in war zones, and sitting in a room like this, in certain parts of the world, a bomb could come right in and take us all out. So we sit in a kind of a heaven realm, in a way, a luxury. And the mind can even then find ways to complain about the lettuce. I mean, I thought it was pretty good. I don't know about you. I don't even know whether it was lettuce. It was something green. Green. I'll get back to that. That's an important footnote, by the way, later in the talk. Figuring things out versus realizing that things are already figured out and you're the only one that thinks they're not. Things are already figured out and you're the only one who believes they're not. And thus, the exploration seems to need to take place for those who have the opportunity to do things like meditation. So I've been saying earlier today, you know, in a way it's an unlearning here. It's an unlearning about how we've been, you know, carrying around the idea of what meditation is. And sometimes it can become very, very habituated and you can start meditating and all you're really doing is generating a habit and you don't even know it. People do this all the time with the breathing. You know, so if you took that simple instruction of see if you can notice where the breath is clearest in the body most of the time. Find that place. Let it find you. Don't make up a decision. There's so many styles of meditation that say, do this, do this, don't do that, do this. And we already have a mind that's tremendously bifurcated about what to do and what not to do. So what does that do to have a teaching that comes in and tells you what to do? Well, guess what? It kind of is attractive because it sounds good, it looks good, it looks like the person's saying it sometimes. It looks like it's working for them. And so we easily, again, go suggestible and we go along. But if we really are honest, and that's a biggie, if we're really honest, what we're about here is releasing the ideas about the meditation, releasing the ideas about what we're trying to do here, what we're trying to get to, what we're trying to maintain, and, of course, what we're trying to figure out. Freeing up what the meditation's been, because any past experience of the meditation, even if it was tremendous experience, say it had a tremendous insight, a tremendous opening, kaput, gone. Now the echo effect, okay, yeah, the ripple effect of certain kinds of openings is very, very important. But just like everything else, the breath, the thought, the feeling, the state, the emotion, the mood, dinner, the lettuce, poof. And we know this, and we, to some extent, accept it. But we easily forget how absolutely, totally reliable and pervasive it is. Because when the meditation experience, or the meditation memory, or the meditation insight, becomes truly fresh, original, spontaneous, authentic, then that's the meditation. It's not about what happened. It's not about what's going to happen. It's about what is happening. It's about what's fundamentally true or real. And this true or realness is what we call insight. Now the insight, or the insights, are not dependent on silence. They're not dependent on stillness. They're not dependent on sitting. They're not dependent on practicing meditation. And, at the same time, silence, stillness, being undistracted. And I would add a very direct and open and easy for the mind to understand meditation practice seems to assist in seeing what is true or real. It's not necessary. In a moment, any human being could be in any activity, waking up from sleeping, going into sleep, moving from deep sleep into dream, moving from dream into the waking state, lifting the finger, brushing the teeth, driving a car. Any of these things that we call ordinary, mundane, ordinary living, these so-called activities, awakening can happen. People awaken when they're going into shock. People awaken when they're coming out of shock. People awaken watching leaves fall from trees. You can say, what are the conditions for that? What are the conditions for awakening? And there's one word for that. The condition is ripeness. Ripeness. It's like that Shakespeare line when he said, ripeness is all, and then he stopped. Or did he put a dot, dot, dot? I don't remember. Ripeness is all. So then you say, how do I get ripe? Oh, I think I'm ripe. I'm ready. Where's the voila? Where's the insight? And if the mind is saying just a little bit of that, it's trying to program this. It's trying to control it. I sit like this and I move like that, and I don't sit like this and I move like that, and I don't move like that, and I just eat this way, and I da-da-da-da-da-da. And subtly in there, it's like, if I do this, then voila, I'll win. I don't even know what it is that I'm trying to win. I've made that up. Oh, no, 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 I know. This stress, this tension, this angst, this discomfort, this will go away. That's voila. I'll have an insight that will free me from this. Little do I realize sometimes, I'm just playing the escapism game. Let me out. I mean, I deserve it. I've worked hard. I'm sincere. In some situations, people go, I paid. I appeared. I organized my life differently. I carved out the time. Does any of that truly evoke ripeness? Is it even up to, quote unquote, you at all? Now people go the other way and they say, oh, okay, right. No control. Can't make anything happen. And the risk there is they go heedless. It's so extreme. The mind goes, I can sit and drink beer and watch the game and voila can happen. I can keep eating beyond what's healthy for the body. That's okay, doesn't matter. Voila can happen. It's absolutely and utterly deluded. Now, I gotta say, I don't know exactly how this works. But I know that it does. I mean, do a role reversal with me for just a moment, okay? If you didn't have a trust or a faith, a sense, even though you couldn't understand in your mind how it works. Would you spend 40 years at something? What I can say is that the opportunity, this is just one kind of opportunity, is to get more deeply acquainted with the naturalness of meditative presence. Now, meditative presence is in this room. Meditative presence doesn't require a meditation retreat. But meditation retreats tend to somehow evoke, invite, encourage, support, allow more of a sense of this meditative presence. What happens when you see meditative presence in the eyes of another human being, and it can be anywhere in that human being or around that human being, but let's just take the eyes, is you see that the eyes are not just looking out. You see that the eyes are actually looking out, but they're reflective somehow to something you might call in. It seems as if there's something in there looking out that's aware of itself looking out. This is just one example. To go a little further with that, if meditative presence is looking out of the eyes of one human being into the eyes of another human being who is resting in meditative presence, that meditative presence in the so-called two becomes one. Because it is one. There's one meditative presence. You could say particularized. Sometimes it's even taken further than that, and you could say divided or separated out amongst human beings. And in an instant, that meditative presence meets itself in the so-called outer, and there's a little bit or a lot of falling away of this notion of inside and outside. Or it's seen that it's just a thought or a perception that says there's an inside and an outside. Now, this meditative presence, the recognition of it, which is a big part of what we're exploring, can wake up. It can flower. And its fragrance can spread. It can spread so far and wide that it fills the whole sense of existence. And guess what? It is, right now, filling the whole sense of existence. But the funny little twist to keep the game interesting, at least in part, is that it's your perception of existence. And your perception of existence is often narrow, biased, and contracted. And you know why it's narrow, biased, and contracted? Is because it's yours. This is my perception of reality. Right there is the narrow, or narrowing. I know this is going to feel like it falls off the cliff, but I can fall off the cliff with you and then I can kind of come back on the edge, okay? So fall off the cliff and come back. Right view, which is the culmination of the Buddhist teachings, is no view. Let's watch what the mind does there. Right view is no view. What? What? What does that mean? Right view is that there is no one who has view. Now, for some minds, they go, I can dig into that a little bit. I can think about that. I can sort on that a little. That can make a little sense to me. The view that the mind has about existence is simply only that. How about this? Existence is a mystery. That's a view. Existence is boundless life. That's a view. Existence is unconditional love. That's a view. Existence is the expression of God. Is God. We're children of God. View, view, view. And we don't stop there. We don't just stop there. We go, there's right views and wrong views. And so when the utterance appeared, right view is no view. For the ripe, made complete sense, makes complete sense. But for those who seem to be ripening, not yet ripe, wow, what do I do with that? What does my view have to say about that? It's got something to say or nothing to say. So I have to say, I don't know exactly how this works, but I know that it does. Now, the teaching of remembrance, or to begin this part of the title of the talk more specifically, the unlearning that opens into clear seeing. The remembrance that I'm using, the way I'm using the term means the recognition or realization, the waking up, that ultimately points to freedom and liberation, ultimately. And here it is. No matter what's happening, no matter when, so here we have content, yeah, what's happening, we have time, when, no matter where, and we have location, and no matter to whom, now we have the idea of someone, there is one and only one presence that is experiencing this. There is one presence that is experiencing what is happening. It's the same presence that was experiencing what was happening when this body was 3 years old, 4 years old, 5 years old, 10 years old, or whatever age this body becomes. And this presence, this awareness, I'm going to use those two words synonymously right now, this presence awareness doesn't actually change, even as that which appears to it or before it is changing. It doesn't move. You might say, well, really? What about when the body moves? It's strange. It doesn't move as the body moves. It's still within the moving body. And it's right here in this room. It's not that the ears hear the sound, that the eyes see the visual object, that the nose smells, that the tongue tastes, that the body feels. It's that whereby those functions can happen. It's absolutely, utterly ordinary and simple and very subtle. And because it's very subtle, it's overlooked. It's forgotten. It's ignored. The teaching of remembrance, the teaching of clear seeing, is to begin to see this. To begin to see this presence awareness And sooner or later it's realized that it is awareness or presence that sees itself. See, it's reflective unto itself. Now, let's look at it from the other way around, because we can come at this from different angles, thank goodness. Seen from the other way around, we could say that as the movie of life plays out on the screen, nothing at all ever happens to the screen, does it? No matter what the movie depicts, no matter how horrible, wonderful, joyful, celebratory, fantastic, the movie is, the screen remains unaffected. This screen is awareness. It is presence. It is that which is most personal, or the other word I like is intimate, which in some cases people describe as innermost, that which is most intimate or innermost, most personal, and at the same time it's impersonal in the sense that it's common to all. I was telling Ibi and Saranji on the way down from Gainesville, that, and Saranji saw too, there was a nature show last night on television with a man, very interesting man, who had spent a year living with turkeys, wild turkeys, and he raised them from the beginning. And at one point he commented on how he was in living with these turkeys and interacting with them and observing them and relating to them and bonding with them and getting sad when they died and celebrating, you know, their beauty. He actually commented that he felt the turkey was more conscious than himself. Turkey was more aware than himself. These are wild turkeys. And he wasn't joking. He was very sincere, it seemed to me, in commenting like that. So maybe this that I'm pointing at, this awareness, this presence, is not just for the humans. It's not just for the human beings. It's not just the most personal or intimate for the human beings. Maybe. Maybe it's looking at us tonight through the stars or the moon or the trees. Maybe the earth is watching us. You know, when tough stuff in the Buddha's meditation, in the last night of his, you could say, journey of awakening, because there's awakening that leads to realization, and realization that leads to liberation. But under the Bodhi tree, the story has it that when the forces of defilement, of Mara, as it's called in Buddhism, the forces of evil, were at full tilt, that he reached down and he touched the earth, and in a way, you could say, confirmed that the earth was his witness, and the earth was his ally, and the earth gave him the right to sit through the storm and see beyond it. We'll never know how it actually happened because we weren't there, but as it's been told to me, it's a nice phrase that the American Indians use, as it's been told to me. So this screen, which is the image that suggests it's out there, this which is most personal, most intimate, which suggests it's in here, this sense that it is that which is behind the eyes, inside the eyes, beyond the eyes, if we go with the eyes as a sense door, is both interpersonal, impersonal, not in the negative sense, but common to all. And how about one more word? It's transpersonal in that it's beyond, it's not limited by that which seems personal. Why? Because this presence awareness doesn't take anything personal. Not even itself. And you know what it feels like, and it's not wrong or right, it just happens. You know what it feels like to take it personal, whatever it is. And sometimes the feedback comes, you're taking this too personal. I know a scientist, and he goes to conferences, and he commented to me, he says, at these conferences, these other scientists, they're absolutely ruthless. They're brutal. They just tear your data apart as if you're not even there. And if you've taken it personal, you feel awful. And they don't care. They don't even notice. They just tear at the data. That doesn't work. And if you're personally invested in that, it's like, I've worked really hard on this. And then they just actually rip it up and show you, or show the audience, or try to show the audience, this is absolutely wrong. And at business meetings, people say, you're not supposed to get emotional. And then everybody blows up later. You know, after the meeting sometimes. With or without the drinks. Meanwhile, I like that word a lot. Meanwhile, this presence awareness is unaffected. It abides, and here's a key word, it abides freely amidst whatever's occurring. And I'm pointing at it because it gets, you could say, lost in the shuffle. This meditative awareness sinks into what I call the ordinary taking care of business, getting by existing awareness. It dims, as if it's like a dimmer switch. It dims and it becomes veiled or shrouded. Basically, what's happening is it starts to be covered by a film of ignoring it. It's called ignorance. Very good to use the verb, put an ing there, ignoring. Ignorance is the ignoring tendency with regards to, in this case right now, the illuminating light of being, which is awareness. So this awareness is continually free of fixation and limitation. It's experiencing itself. Yeah, it is. It's experiencing itself through all the forms of experience that are occurring. It's not just experiencing the experience. It's experiencing itself within the experience of whatever's occurring. So in many times our life and our interest can really, it can really spread out. Have you ever felt like you've got too many things happening? Like you're just a little bit too spread. There's a little bit too much. Or the other end of the coin, there's not enough happening. You know, it can move back and forth. But the point I want to make is that our interest in life, our interest in this, you know, nature here, of living can get quite spread and get quite divided at times. Varieties of interests, different kinds of aspirations. We can get actually quite ADD-ish, quite spread about, quite unfocused. But when our earnestness or our interest comes together, when it coalesces, and that's partly what meditation is, then it begins to reveal this presence. Not just more clearly what's happening. There's the thought, there's the sensation, there's the sound, there's the taste. These ordinary things that make up, you could say, the flow of life, relatively speaking. But this interest begins to see or assist in the awakening of this presence, this awareness that sees. And then the possibility of clear seeing can arise. We don't make this happen, but our sincere, keen, and you could say gathered interest can assist and it can inspire. So instead of the notion of getting inspired about certain things, what insight meditation helps reveal is the possibility to be inspired by exactly what is happening. Free from bias about the content. That's why people will sit sometimes and they'll be having, you might say, quite a bit of bodily pain, which is really just unpleasant sensation. And it's quite unpleasant. And if we put a little, like, gauge on it, we could say, whoa, that's right up there on the Richter scale. You know, that's really banging along there. That's a strong, unpleasant sensation. And yet there is this profound interest, curiosity, non-reactive equanimity, openness, presence that sees this. So, the reason why some of what I'm saying gets fairly at times muddled and confused is that there's a lot of spiritual teachings on the planet. And to keep it simple for the moment, they really fall into two categories. There's teachings of progressive nature, or progressive, you could say, evolution or awakening or enlightenment, and then there's instantaneous. There's progressive and there's instantaneous. There are progressive teachings that say that there's something you can do about your situation, and the way that you need to facilitate this transformation is you need to stop doing certain things. There's certain things you're doing that are out of balance, they're out of harmony, they're wrong. And if you look closely, you can see they're harming you. And so here's a teaching to help you not do that. And we'll also tell you what to do. So we're going to tell you what not to do, but we're also going to tell you what to do. And if you do this effectively, if you do this correctly, if you do this well enough, if you do that, and sometimes very tricky, if you do this as I have done it, then you can wake up. You can get free. You can be at peace. You can get to heaven. You can avoid hell. And you can realize what you are, etc. Sometimes they even say, tomorrow. Or, this weekend. By the end of the retreat. And if you don't, you're not doing it right. You didn't understand. You didn't read the pamphlet carefully. You didn't do it right. It suggests that there is someone who can wake up. There's an individual, there's a being that can wake up. And here's how you do it. This that I just described is not only fundamentally contradictory with regards to so-called teachings about instantaneousness, but even these progressive teachings are contradictory at times. They're dualistic in the sense, at times, they assume and they present vigorously that there is a subject-object relatedness. There's a subject, that's you, and there's an object, that's things, and there's a relatedness between these things, and it's not just an interior subject-object relatedness, it's a so-called exterior. There's you, and there's others. And if you're going to get it together, if you're going to get it right, if you're going to get well, if you're going to get homogenized, if you're going to heal, if you're going to be okay, you're going to have to straighten this stuff out. You're going to have to get it sorted out. You're going to have to find some balance within it. And of course, they go on to say, if you find a balance within it, if you get it right, so to speak, then you're going to, at least hopefully, get free. You're going to get whole. You're going to be happy. And you're going to get enlightened, and here's the path. Here are the teachings. Here's how you do it. They appeal to your mind. They appeal to your thoughts. They appeal to your feelings. They appeal to your dreams. They appeal to your hopes. And they all have one thing in common. They always promise a better tomorrow. No contradiction there. They promise a better tomorrow. They're for the mind. They're for the conditioned mind. Which, by the way, the conditioned mind is itself the basis of the subject-object dichotomy, or the subject-object relatedness. That is the conditioned mind. They say, these teachings do, that there are problems here. There is suffering here. And there's paths or ways out of it. Other teachings, more of the instantaneous, immediate, or sometimes called direct approach, say this subject-object dichotomy is simply a perception. And it doesn't occur to a subject. There's no subject that the subject-object perception occurs to. It's just a perception. And yet it conditions thoughts and feelings and, of course, behavior. And in fact, it goes further to say ultimately or truly there is no subject-object dichotomy or duality. Life is essentially whole, undivided, complete, and doesn't need anything added to it or taken away from it, and there's no progression. There's nothing to get. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to be. Life is already free as itself, and you are that life. You are already whole, undivided, complete, and free, and this simply needs to be recognized. Oh, boy. Simply needs to be recognized. They say this. And they don't really appeal to the mind, except the mind that's ready to say, is it that easy? Is it that simple? But how do I do it, that mind says. You see, that mind is the subject then, isn't it? And the object has become that which I'm going to do or understand. Now watch this. These same teachings, these same immediate, direct approach, instantaneous teachings, they say this perception of dichotomy is not only just a perception, but it arises for human beings in the developmental process right around the age of 2, chronologically, and the whole sense of separation, suffering, and seeking, resolution from this suffering, begins at that point in the development of the human. And by the way, neuroscience is actually getting this stuff kind of researched. They're saying there's no I in the brain, it's just a bundle of firing neurons, synapses, without a center. They're starting to say these things, and people are listening. It's not just a few wild, bushy-haired Einsteins. More people are coming to the realization that there's no I or me in here. They're coming through different angles. I would simply say, it's about time. Moreover, just to keep it interesting in the game, the arising of this perception of separation, roughly at the age of 2 in the development of the human, is absolutely and utterly unavoidable. In order for it to be viewed as unavoidable, it would then suggest it's natural and it's correct, that there's nothing wrong with it. Whether you want to call it the fall from grace, if you like the allegory of Adam and Eve eating from the fruit and therefore going into the spin. Suffering, separation are natural and correct. seeking something beyond suffering then would be natural and correct. And inevitable. Right? Because if home has appeared and then apparently disappeared, how many amongst us could not seek reunion? You could try to sleep all day long, and you can't sleep your way out of this. You can't sleep your way out of this natural, unavoidable, correct situation. And even more to the point, there is no liberation from suffering without suffering. No waking up from the trance of suffering without suffering. And let me go one more layer. Maybe even more compelling. If there is such a thing. Is that there's a fact that this perception, for most human beings, conditions the sense of separation and therefore conditions the sense of suffering and therefore conditions the sense of seeking and therefore conditions the view that this is not a fully integrated, seamless tapestry. And that something needs to be removed for that seamless tapestry be realized. Something's in the way. It's this seeking, suffering, angst, strain, stress, whatever you call it. This has to go. And the suggestion here is, no, it doesn't. It's perfectly fine that it's present. It's perfectly fine and necessary and natural to quote unquote fall from grace. Or the mind says, no, it's not. It's a mistake. It's a blunder. And it has to be removed. What if, keywords, what if it doesn't have to be removed? It doesn't have to change. It doesn't have to be altered in any way. What if it's perfectly fine that it's present? Just like we'd say it's perfectly fine that the blue sky is present. It's perfectly fine that my tasty meal was served. It's perfectly fine that I have some peace of mind. It's perfectly fine that I slept soundly. It's perfectly fine that I feel love in my heart for others. Why, if those things are perfectly fine, would I say this taint, if you will, this angst, this sense of incompleteness, this sense of seeking, this sense of suffering, call it what you will. What right do I have to say that isn't also perfect? The sense of separation or dissatisfaction, that's what the Buddha called it, dukkha. Dukkha, translated as unsatisfactoriness. Even another interesting term for it was unreliability. Have you noticed how unreliable even your dearest ones can sometimes be? I've noted it as an intentional action. You need to accept that the world does not revolve around you, Paul. It turns out, when there's a turning, here's the Tibetan teaching, the turning of the mind, the turning from the entrancement with conditioning, the entrancement with there's something wrong, not to just another view that it's all just fine. Try that. Use that mantra. Just say to yourself over and over and over and over, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay. You know what that confirms? That you believe you're not okay. This sense of separation or unsatisfactoriness, dissatisfaction, unreliability, is either seamlessly interconnected with everything else, or it isn't. And the one who says it isn't is the one who says that unsatisfactoriness has to go. It has to go. And the path, the progressive path, says, here's how you get it to go. Very popular. Here's how you get it to go. I want the proof. I want the evidence. I'm not sure what you really want, but I want the proof. I want the evidence. I want the facts. And you can't be a spectator on this business if you want the facts. You got to go full participation. You got to get in the ocean. You can't just look at it. And the legacy, you know, the history of awakening, those beings that you could say spawned the spiritual teachings that are on the planet, these characters looked, and they looked carefully. And their stories are diverse and different and fascinating and confusing. But they looked. There was some key things there, not just that ripeness I speak about perhaps, but there was earnestness. There was an interest. What seeing clearly in part means, for the business of the talk tonight, is to see that this sense of separation, this sense of suffering, this sense of seeking is an appearance. It's a view. Or if you don't like that word, it's a belief. And even more, all that's happening is an appearance. Now, this gets a little tricky, but I'll say it. This, right now, is a waking dream. And what I mean by that is that we would easily agree that the dream that happens at night comes and goes. It's juxtapositioned by the conscious states, and then there's the dream states, and then there's the conscious states, and we say that was a dream, it came and went. If we look a little bit closer, we see the conscious states also are coming and going. Even if you just go very simply to, they're gone when the dream appears. And just to keep it more interesting, I think at least for myself, there's something called deep sleep, where both the waking state and the dream state are gone. That appears to humans. It's another appearance. It comes and goes. What is real, absolutely or fundamentally, doesn't come and go. And the gate or portal for the human into that is awareness, presence. In the same way that light dissolves the darkness, clear seeing reveals that the sense of separation is an appearance, and the sense of suffering is also an appearance, and the idea that there's someone who's suffering is also an appearance. Relativity is an appearance. Now, one aspect of this appearance, this true nature of appearance, is that all experiences and forms dissipate. And therefore, the sense of separation, seeking, release from separation, even what we would call unification, some space that opens where there's no separation, is simply a form of experience. It's an appearance. It's a state. And clear seeing reveals this. Or you could say nothing lasts. So now, if we're talking about where this points, it would say that there's no path to that which is continually true. The only thing that might look like a path is that there appears to be some kind of difference in the mind of the seeker and those who aren't seeking anymore. Because if you think you're not awakened and you think somebody else is, then your mind constructs there must be a path from where I am to where you are. Little do you know that you're looking at yourself, your true self, when you look at any other being. That's what the man found with the turkeys, although he didn't quite say it. At least that's what I thought he found. See, you can make it up to a certain extent if it feels right. In realization, all separation is neutralized. In fact, eliminated. There's just complete equality. Or I like to use the term justice. Justice is served. There's no higher, lower, better, worse anywhere or in anything. The idea of waking up to this is viewed by the conditioned mind as a path. Whereas, in fact, it's simply a remembrance. Waking up has no path to it. There's no direction to this. Even if you think about this, it can be seen. It can begin to be seen. Even if you think about it. How can there be a path to what always already is? What always already is hiding in this room. It's hiding inside these bodies. And it's presence or awareness that can begin to realize it. Because that presence awareness is it. So no matter what kind of beliefs or theories about spirituality, meditation, God, or what we are or what we aren't that we take on, when we come right down to it, it doesn't matter what any theories say. It doesn't matter what anybody else says. It doesn't matter, really, what the scriptures say. What matters is what you see for yourself. And if any of those things that occupy a lot of book space and time and effort and sometimes finances, because religion on planet Earth has a lot of power and it involves a lot of economic, you could say, force. But it's got to be verified in one's own experience if it's really true. And if you've carried around ideas about these things, and your direct experience proves it to be true, then voila. Okay, you were right. So the silence we've been touching on can assist in us seeing clearly. Our togetherness can resonate in such a way it helps. But we do this for one possibility and one possibility only, and that is to see the truth of life the way it really is. And I've talked briefly about the uncomplicated nature of this, seeing how things naturally can uncomplicate. The brain, mind, thought, belief, structure, memory can uncomplicate in the silence. We can begin to see that all our concepts and all of our thinking, actually, as fascinating as it may be to us, in a way complicates life tremendously. And trying to think our way out of these complications is akin to trying to think your way to real happiness. And the big aha is that it just never works. Like I said before dinner, life is living itself through these body minds. The most important thing we could ever be doing is what we're actually doing. All there ever is what is actually happening. In order to untangle this confusion that causes seeking a better, different life somewhere other than where we actually are, we need to see that there is no real happiness in having possessions. There's no real happiness in experiencing nice events and situations. There's no real or true happiness and fulfillment in money, pretty things, and even pleasant feelings and sensations. Now, some people go at that point, oh, that sounds morbid, pessimistic. That sounds negative. It's absolutely not negative. It's not pessimistic. It's not morbid. It's factual. And this is the important thing that helps us see that it's factual. These things are fine. We're well past the idea that you have to be a full-on renunciate and get rid of all that stuff so that you can see the truth. You know, you need to eat a certain way and not have sex, or if you do, have it a certain way, and blah, 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 blah. Those archaic views about what you have to do or not do to be free as you are, the burden of that. See, you can get rid of all your stuff and then be attached. I have a friend like this. I haven't seen him in a long time. He gets always trying to get rid of stuff. He's unbelievably attached to being unattached. It's his M.O. And you can't penetrate it with him. You can't really just even question it. He believes that it is the way. It's not the things. In a way, it's the relationship to the things. But I'm wanting to say it this way. There is no true happiness in things. There is temporary joy, lightness in these experiences, some degree of fleeting fulfillment. But real fulfillment, real happiness, is discovered when there's an opening into that which sees, when that which sees is uncovered. Initially, that which sees is unseen. In the same way that the eyes see, but the eyes cannot see themselves, can they? The eyes can't look at themselves, can they? That which sees is unseen in the same way that the eyes cannot see themselves. That which is, you could say in Hinduism, it's called the seer, capital S, is unseen in part because we're very concerned and identified with form. We're very concerned and identified with the form of the body, the feelings, the thoughts. We're very concerned and identified with the forms of experience we're having. And we're quite disidentified, unconscious, blind, and in ignorance of the formless nature of life. The formless nature of being, the formless nature of what is. And guess what? Awareness is formless. Notice this right now. Awareness, presence, is absolutely formless. It's completely and utterly the most obvious thing in this room, in a way, and it's absolutely and utterly invisible. It has no fixed locale. Can you see this? It has no fixed location. It cannot be located. So that means it has no center. There is no center to awareness presence, and there's no circumference. It's not an object of knowledge. And so what happens then is the mind, conditioned mind, says, oh, awareness is the subject. I am awareness. Now here's the thought. It grabs it and says, I am awareness. And I would say, rest right there, if you'd like. Prove it. And you can't. See? You don't know what you are. And instead of that being, oh, well, yeah, I'm going to go on and figure out what I can figure out. I'm just going to go to work. I'm just going to, like, focus on what I can understand. If there's a resting, the release from the herky-jerky reactive tendency, and just see that which is so subtle, so elusively obvious, and notice the effect of that seeing. Because the effect of that seeing of the seer, awareness presence, is amazing. It's so amazing that in the history of the evolution of spirituality on this planet, it was kept in secret places. It was held in the caves, and it was shared through a hole from one cave to the other, because if it got out, and the minds, the insane, crazy, ritualistic, dogmatic, attached minds of the religious ones got a hold of it, they kill it. They crucify it. This formless nature of being, this formless nature of what is what sees the forms. So then, what does that mean? Life is being, yeah, life is being, life is being itself through these body minds as part of that life. And life is being itself as form and formlessness. Or if you like the terms, form and emptiness. And so we then come back in a way and take a look and say, well, I think I still have to get things straightened out in the relative plane, in the world of form. I'm still conflicted, I'm still neurotic, I'm still emotional, I'm still moody. I still need to just get sort of the house straightened up. I have someone I know who's struggling immensely with trying to straighten up the house. It's an amazing process. Good place to start when you don't know how to straighten up the house is the garage. There's plenty of people who you can hire if you simply have the means and clarity to tell them what to do. But they will probably ask something of you. Every now and then you can get somebody who'll come in if you like are lucky enough or you pay them enough, and you just say, take care of it, and you go away. And then they do it. And you come back and you go, that's great. It meets your approval. It's risky. Because if your garage is a problem, if your house and the innards of it are a problem, do you think turning it over to somebody else is going to solve that? We have a very, very strange relationship to faith. A lot of confusion about faith. But I can say this. When that which sees, when the formless nature of being, awareness, presence, the seer, whatever you call it, begins to be recognized, simultaneously, you can prove this for yourself, all these things must and should be verified directly for yourself, you can see that if there's disturbance in the world of form for you, there's disturbance in the form of the body, there's disturbance in the mental stream, there's disturbance relationally, there's disturbance in your decision-making process, there's some disturbances there. Those disturbances, to some extent, and sometimes a very deep extent, those disturbances are harmonized through the recognition of that which sees the disturbance. That formless nature of being that has no problems with anything, that movie screen that's never affected by the movie, when that's recognized, this is a wonderful thing. Your so-called psychology, to some extent, harmonizes. I'm not saying everything gets worked out, because that would be voila, wouldn't it? Just recognize the formless nature of your being and all the issues that could possibly arise between you and other human beings, between you and money, between you and death, all those arguments, all those challenges, neutralized permanently. I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm just saying I haven't seen it. As we begin to abide as that which is abiding, as we begin to abide which as that which is abundant. Isn't that apparently what Jesus said? He said, I want you to have the abundant life, and I want you to have it now. This seeing, this awareness presence, is naturally abundant. But not with the things. It's the absence of those things. It's the uncomplicated openness. It doesn't need anything. And this doesn't make the forms of experience irrelevant. It doesn't make them irrelevant and doesn't make them go away in most cases. What happens is they actually become that much richer. The very pain in the knee that you prefer to not be having, or back, wherever it shows up, that very sensation that was once unsatisfactory becomes all that much more rich, interesting, actually wonderful. That which appeared to be tainted turns inside out right before your eyes. And it seems to happen gradually. But as this clear scene and its free fulfilled nature is not ignored more and more, it reveals also that everything matters and everything matters equally. And that's the true justice or true equality. Clear seeing is utterly, completely beyond judgment, comparison, and opinion. So beyond judgment, comparison, opinions is clear seeing that clear seeing fully allows judgments, comparison, and opinions. It has no argument with them, no war, no conflict. And thus, judgment, comparison, opinions, views and beliefs, seeking and all forms of suffering, on the spot, for an instant, if that's all it is neutralized. And this distinction-making part of the mind, that part of the mind that makes the value assessments, subtle as they may be, it just decentralizes in clear seeing. It doesn't really matter whether it's there or not there, because it no longer means the same thing. And the biggest judgment, yeah, the biggest comparison, the biggest opinion in town is, of course, there is the view of that which is better, and there is the view of that which is worse. That's the biggie. And when that comes decentralized, when that loses its centrality through the action of clear seeing, then it doesn't matter whether it's there or not. There's what's called the inner smile of clear seeing, or the smile of the Buddha, that shines whether the comparison is floating through the mind or not. And if this labeling, shall I say when? This labeling, assessing, evaluating tendency drops even for a second. In that second, there is no identification and there's no identifier. There is no subject and there's no object separation. There's just what is. And that's voila. Life is revealed as it is, then and there. There's no ownership. There is no solidity. There is no permanence. There is no better. There is no worse. There is no higher. There is no lower. There is no view. There's just clear seeing. And clear seeing is not a view. And there's no one who has clear seeing. Just like there's no one who has awareness. Right? Unless you say it with the thought, I have awareness. That's a thought. I have awareness. And I would say, stop right on. Stop right there if you want to. Prove it. Prove that you have awareness. And nobody can do it, and that's why it's not true. Okay. So there. So someone who says it way better than myself, I feel, is T.S. Eliot. So we'll end with T.S. Eliot tonight. He just, I don't know how he does it. See if you can just let this take you. Or maybe differently. See how clear seeing appears within this passage. Desire itself is movement, not in itself desirable. Love is itself unmoving. Only the cause and end of movement. Timeless and undesiring, except in the aspect of time. Caught in the form of limitation, between unbeing and being. Sudden, in a shaft of sunlight, even while the dust moves, there rises the hidden laughter of children in the foliage. Quick, now, here, now, always. Ridiculous, the waste, sad time, stretching before and after. Thank you very much for your attention to these things.